Talking about property, real estate, we're talking specifically about non-residential real estate. You want to ask questions about residential real estate, come question time, I'm happy to handle that. But what I want to focus on is the non-residential sector. And what I want to do is offer you two major themes. And the first is that the strong performance of direct real estate markets, that's not securitized, not listed property trusts, but the direct tangible stuff, the shopping centers, the offices, in recent years has been due to the growth, capital growth generated by a one-off and probably permanent, important word, permanent decline in yields or capitalization rates, and I use yields and capitalization rates interchangeably, that broadly corresponds with a decline in the cost of, in the real cost of capital. I'll explain that in more detail in about 3 minutes' time. And secondly, that the sharp decline in the A-REIT sector, that's the listed property trust sector, can in large part be explained as a reflection of activities extraneous to the direct property. In other words, it's a reflection of offshore investment, a reflection of debt, a reflection of exposure to other non-property related activities. And what you're seeing in the A-REIT sector, the sharp fall in listed property trusts, you should not regard, I don't think, as a predictor of what's going to happen to direct property. Now, what I want to do in the next 25 minutes or so is to convince you that there's some validity to those two propositions. And I also want to look then briefly at what that means going forward for investment returns and asset values. We've got a short list of what you might call left-of-field risks, and finish up with a couple of opportunities. What you're seeing in that diagram goes back to 1985, and you're looking at the performance of a number of asset classes, predominantly direct property. The blue line is retail. The red dotted line is the industrial market. The light blue line is the office market. Then you've also got the all ords, and that's that line which goes right up to the top and then collapses. And you've got the A-REIT, or the listed property trust index, and that's the other line which collapses right at the end. The data here goes up to March 2008. So it finishes then, and the reason it finishes then is because as of last week when I prepared this, we didn't have June quarter data for the direct property market. As of yesterday, we do, and I'll bring you up to date on that as we go through. But it's quite clear when you look at that chart that when you look at direct property, that's offices, shopping centers, what you see is a relatively smooth and apparently untroubled steady rise in the performance. This is the accumulation index, so it's income plus capital growth. What you see with the All Ords and what you see with the A-REIT sector is also a steady rise, but perhaps not quite so steady. And you also see, as we are only too well aware, the very sharp fall which commenced around about Christmas Day, and which has been with us for the last 6 months or so. All these numbers on the left here, this is the sort of thing you get from most fund managers will produce this. It shows the major asset classes, Australian shares, global shares, property securities, listed property trusts, fixed interest, cash, and direct property, going back to 1989. This particular table comes courtesy of Colonial First State. And what I've done here is mark in red for each year, which is the winning asset class. Direct property, and this, there's a little asterisk, this is up to March, 18.1%. The last time direct property was the top performer was 1989, long time between drinks. Property securities, you can see, had a very strong run here, minus 36% up to June. Australian shares, minus 13%. Had we updated that for the June quarter, that 18.1% would be at 13.2. So it's come down, but even then, direct property remains the top performing asset in the year to June 08. That little chart on the right is the usual risk return chart. The heading there says some surprises. I think there are, to me, that when I updated this chart, there are two surprises in that chart. The first is how neatly the various asset classes sort of move up that line. Higher risk means higher return. It hasn't always been like that. And the other big surprise, of course, is that when you look at REITs, listed property trusts, suddenly they've moved out to be the most risky class. We always thought that REITs LPTs were a nice, stable, reliable sector. Apparently, not anymore. In fact, they're more risky than the rest of the share market over this period. Now, in order to understand, I believe, what's going to happen next, we need to understand what's been happening. And this table shows you for the major direct asset classes, retail, office, industrial, and composite, which is the average of all the commercial sectors, the returns broken down, and this is 18.1%, remember, which goes up to March, broken down into capital growth and income. And capital growth in the year to March was 11%, and income was 6%. In other words, two-thirds of the return, roughly, came from capital growth, and one-third came from income. Now, that's a key part of the story, because that's been the key driver. Where's the capital growth come from? What generated capital growth? What you're looking at here is capitalization rates or yields, going back 10 years to 1997. Let's look at the red line. Look at the red line. That's the cap rate or the yield on shopping centers. And because this is the IPD, Investor Property Database Index, these are predominantly institutional-grade shopping centers, the Westfields, okay, the big shopping centers. And if you go back to 1997, you could buy a Westfield on about an 8% yield. And as you follow that red line for the last 10 years, 13, 11 years, for as long as a lot of us care to remember retrospectively, we've been living in a market where that yield has been falling steadily, 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 down to about 6% for a Westfield shopping center. The top line is industrial. You can see how that's fallen in much the same way. The office market's a bit more ambiguous, but generally it's fallen as well. Now, it's that fall in yields which has generated growth. And presumably, everyone has to agree that sooner or later that fall in yields is going to stop. And that's what's happened now. It's stopped. And if you look at what's happening in the UK and the US, it hasn't just stopped, it's going backwards. Going up, yields are going up. Falling yields must mean, a fall in the yield must mean that values are rising faster than rents. Rents are rising at 5%, values are rising at 6%, the yield falls, and that's what's been happening. Is that a problem? Well, I put it to you that I'm going to offer you the proposition that it's not a problem for this particular asset class, these institutional-grade assets, the Westfields, the trophy buildings you see on the skyline of Sydney office market, the good quality industrial assets out there. Why is it not a problem? Well, this bit of barbed wire down at the bottom there is the real risk-free rate in Australia. 10 years ago, Westfield was 8%, a Westfield shopping centre was 8%. The real risk-free rate was just above 4%. There was about 3.5 to 4% difference between, this is the risk premium, that's the additional reward you get for investing in a prime shopping centre. And that gap has remained remarkably constant through time. Think about that first proposition. The fall in the yield for those shopping centres, for those prime assets, can be explained by the fall in the real cost of capital. Had we put up the chart for the UK or for the US, you'd see a very different picture. You'd see that compressing very sharply, particularly over the last 2 to 3 years. In other words, the risk premium in Australia has remained relatively constant. That yield compression was the key driver of capital growth. You've had the same experience in your house. Where do you live? You live in Sydney, you live in Perth, especially if you live in Perth. For the last 10 years, most days, you get out of bed in the morning and you're richer than you were when you went to bed. House prices have risen. Not because of anything that you've done. It's just been a wonderful experience for all of us. And if you've been a portfolio manager managing shopping centres or offices for the last 10 years in Australia, it's been the same wonderful experience because the value of your portfolio just rose along with yield compression. Okay, it's been perfect. Unfortunately, the dream has now come to an end. The yield compression is approximately equal to the decline in the underlying cost of capital. So the property risk premium for prime-grade assets has been relatively stable in Australia. Therefore, I offer you the proposition that the underlying value of those assets looks reasonable. Pragmatically, what's going to happen over the next 12 months? I think you'll see some modest decompression. I think there is a cycle there, and I think you'll see those yields rise, but not dramatically. However, the yield compression process has now ended, and we're going to have to. And that is not a painless process. We're going to have to live with the impact of that over the next 12 months, probably longer, the next 5 years. Okay, now that's direct property we've been talking about. Offices, shopping centers. Let's look at the listed property sector. This chart shows you the listed property sector, REITs or LPTs, Japan, Australia is the blue line, US, the UK. If you'd invested $100 in the listed property sector in each of these markets in January 07, in the UK, your $100 would now be worth about $60. You've lost $40. In Australia, your $100 would now be worth about, that's 70, if you've lost $25. Those indices have all behaved very similarly. They've all fallen dramatically. But I think that it's a mistake to assume that the explanation is the same in all those markets. I think that if you look at the US, the UK, and also Japan, what you're seeing there in the listed sector is anticipating the fall in the underlying values. And if you look at the value of offices in the City of London or shopping centres in Bond Street, I can tell you they've fallen plenty. They've fallen 15, 20, 25%. So the listed property trust sector, or the property trust sector in the UK, is correctly anticipating what's going to happen to the direct property market. But I think in Australia, I think it's a different story. I think it's a different story because in Australia, we no longer have simple REITs. The REITs in Australia are now stapled. And typically, they do all sorts of other stuff. Mirvac does a lot of residential development, often very successfully, but the residential market we know is relatively depressed at the moment. If you look at what's happened to the listed sector in Australia and break it down, I think what's happened in the listed sector is not simply a mass exit. I think the market's been quite rational. And this chart shows you what's happened year to date in Australia for those REITs which have offshore exposure, those with mixed exposure, those with domestic exposure. If you've got a REIT with offshore exposure, you've fallen much more because investors are worried about the US market, they're worried about the UK, they're worried about exchange rate risk. And this chart doesn't show it, but if you look at the debt breakdown, the REITs that have fallen most have also been those with highest levels of debt. And I think the market's been quite rational. But for those REITs that are exposed purely to the domestic underlying real estate market, they've fallen, but it hasn't been anything like the rout which you've seen in a lot of the other parts of the market. Therefore, I think that the sharp fall in the REIT sector does not necessarily predict a fall in the underlying real estate values. The market, I think, reflects worried about offshore markets, exchange rate risk, high levels of debt, lease expiry profiles, and you can contrast that with what's happened in the UK and the US. Okay, so that's if you like, my perspective on what's happened. Let's look at a few other questions briefly. Investment returns. These are the numbers that you saw a few minutes ago. This is 1 year to March, okay? This is 23 years. Let's look at the composite. This is direct property. Over 23 years, direct property has produced a return of 10%, and that 10% is broken down into capital growth of 3% and income of 7.3%. Commercial property in Australia and in other places is actually, it's a high yield, low growth asset. 3.3% capital growth over 23 years. The inflation rate over 23 years has been 3.2%. So what is commercial property? It's an inflation indexed investment. What you get is protection against inflation, and that's the rise in the asset values. Okay? Plus you get the yield. So we think about the yield as being the real return. And the rest is simply a protection against inflation. The office market, for example, 2.2% average capital growth, inflation 3.2%. All those buildings that you can see on the skyline from here, if you look across at Sydney CBD, those buildings are worth less now in real terms than they were a quarter of a century ago. But they produce a quite a reasonable return, 9.2%, okay, over time. And remember, it's been a stable return, so it's been a relative, until recently, it's been a relatively riskless return. And I think that's what you're going to get back to. I think the way to think about the market going forward is you should be looking for a return of about 10%. And that 10% will be roughly capital growth of 3%, which is roughly the inflation rate, and you'll get a yield of roughly 7%. If you look at these numbers here, it's 6.5, 7.3, 6.3. That's pretty much what we've had. That's what you're going to get going forward. But if you're looking for double-digit returns, then I suggest you look at some other asset class, because direct property isn't going to produce it for you, at least over the next few years. Some risks. Well, on a risk-adjusted basis, the best-performing asset class until recently in Australia was unquestionably retail shopping centres. And what this shows you, the dotted line shows you the performance of regional shopping centres. The green line shows you the performance of sub-regional shopping centres. That's the smaller ones. And the blue line shows you the performance of neighbourhood shopping centres. That's a little shop, little centre with five stores that when you call in, buy your beer and take away food on the way home. Okay, little neighbourhood centres. You can see that the smaller the centre, the better it's performed over the last, since 1991. Okay. If you look at the yields, this barbed wire, these are the inflation index bonds. These are the regional centres we looked at before. That's the steady, stable gap. The neighbourhood centres, those yields have come down very sharply. 10 years ago, you could buy a Westfield shopping centre on a yield of 8 or a neighbourhood centre on a yield of 11. There was a 300 basis point reward for being in a relatively high risk, small investment. Until recently, the market has been saying Westfield Bondi, the little centre on the way home, not much difference, very little difference. Okay, now that's about to change, I think. And if you want to know where the risks lie not in retail investments, but in certain types of retail investments. I actually think there's some very good neighbourhood shopping centres out there. So I don't have the knife into neighbourhood shopping centres, but I would caution you against those assets which are poorly located, bad demographics, high levels of debt, because I think that is where the shoe is going to pinch over the next 12 months, 2 years, 3 years. This chart, this data comes from PIR, Property Income Research. These are syndicates, and this diagram shows you the closed-end syndicates shows you the expiry profile of closed-end property syndicates, and this chart shows you the gearing level, 60-80%. As the syndicates expire. Very often these are average assets, highly leveraged, a lot of them going to mature over the next 2 to 3 years. It's very hard not to see a significant shakeout coming in that market sector, for example, simply because investors have done very well in the past, they're less likely to do well in the future, and trying to refinance those syndicates with a high cost of debt now and with low growth going forward is going to be a lot more difficult. areas of risk. If we could wind the clock back 10 years, and if we were sitting here 10 years ago and we said, how are we going to make money out of real estate? There are a couple of rules that you would have put in place. First of all, you would have invested in second-grade assets because, as you see, the capital growth was much better. Invest in second-grade assets. Use debt to enhance returns, okay? Because debt was cheap and you could obviously crank up your returns much better. And thirdly, borrow short and lend long. Borrow short because interest rates were falling, so every time you rolled the debt over, you got a better deal than you'd have before. Second-grade assets, lots of debt, borrow short and lend long. Do you think those rules are going to work in the future? Because not many people do. Cost of debt is higher. The growth cycle has ended. Liquidity preference has risen. And with the economy slowing, perhaps not dramatically, but slowing, there's obviously increased risk of vacancy, lower rental growth. We think it's obvious that you've got to be very selective now about the market sectors, but also about the ownership structure which you have in place. Because things which worked well in a falling interest rate environment with high growth are less likely to work well in a rising interest rate, or at least a high interest rate environment with low growth. A couple of other left of field risks, and this is a bit of a checklist. Tax and regulatory shifts, we all know too much about that. The goalposts can shift unexpectedly, unpredictably, and adversely without very much warning. Obsolescence, I think it's an underestimated, particularly perhaps by some professional analysts who they look at the vacancy rates, they look at absorption, they look at supply, they look at demand, they do the arithmetic, but there's a big gorilla, especially in the office market, and that is green environmental issues, which are going to probably speed up the obsolescence of quite a lot of older buildings. And we have a very old office stock in Australia because we haven't built much office stuff since the last boom in the late 80s. So there's an obsolescence factor, which is a sort of hidden risk one should be aware of. There's technology over the longer term, workspace ratios, which are falling steadily, not dramatically, but there's a steady decline. And other things like shopping from home. I've never tried it, but I'm told it's a popular thing to do. And then, of course, there is supply. Supply, unlike the last property collapse in the early 90s, supply is not a problem this time. Supply is quite modest in most parts of the most locations, most market sectors. But that's not universally the case. One can think of certain areas. We think about Southeast Queensland, for example, where in the retail sector there's a lot of supply coming through. And if the market does slow, then supply is something you should at least have on your checklist of things to worry about if that's what you like to do. opportunities. The REIT sector. It's very hard, having seen that, and I've said the sell down hasn't been irrational, it's been quite rational, but it's very hard not to see that there's some very good quality counters traded on the stock market, which are implying a big fall in underlying property values. And as I've tried to convince you, I think that's unlikely to happen, certainly not to the extent that the market is pricing it in. So there was mispricing on the way up, there's mispricing on the way down in the share market. But we are going to see a lot of consolidation. The number of property trusts is going to be much smaller in 2 years' time than it is now. Look for consolidation in the sector. We think that there are opportunities also, and one should look at non-core assets. I happen to think that the hotel sector is a very interesting sector. It's hard to get into. You have to consider the management issues around it, but the sector is going to consolidate, and it's going to vertically integrate, because when you're getting increasing numbers of visitors coming from China, coming from Korea, and perhaps to a lesser extent from Japan, that vertical integration with the airlines and the hotels and the tourist shops and all the destinations and so on is clearly a positive. Retirement, demographics. Retirement is clearly an area where there has to be a lot of investment in real estate over the next 5, 10, 15 years. The real question around that is always just how robust is the financial model, because it's a very different financial model from your average housing development. And a third area which we think is interesting is we think there's going to be, over the next few years, a development of debt products, and debt hasn't always been a successful investment. Debt in real estate hasn't always been a successful investment in recent years, but if it's done properly, particularly with the exit of a lot of debt providers and the fact that the banks are pulling back, debt and real estate are intrinsically, debt and real estate always go together, but it has to be done well, it has to be done prudently. In the US, a lot of real estate debt is provided by institutions, by the pension funds in the US. And we would expect, particularly with the banks pulling back, we would expect to see institutions increasingly moving into that space. They like high yield, They just want to make sure that it's managed correctly. And with the bond market so small, $50 billion, $60 billion in Australia, there's clearly a demand for that kind of investment. And right now, the spreads are particularly generous. And Stephen is well positioned, if you want to know more details about it, to identify where opportunities lie, where you can prudently, in this kind of market, identify very good opportunities for rewards which are well matched with the intrinsic risks. So I think that's probably about it. So I'll hand back to the chairman.
Thank you. Look, I suspect there's going to be a lot of questions, and David, you've given us a bit of time to do that. I'll ask Peter to lead off with a question, then we'll open the floor up, and we've got probably 15 minutes on our side.
Sure. Great presentation, Dave. Really good. Especially showing the link between cap rates and the bond rate. I think that's something people should really keep in mind with property. I guess this has been a bit of a futuristic conference. So my question is about the future of A rates. And where you see they'll end up. Do you think we're going to have a return to the list of rent collectors? Or do you think there's still a future for the stapled structure, given what's happened in the last 12 months?
I think you'll see a more diverse offering. If you look at everyone thinks the listed property trust sector is sort of boring, and it, you know, you've got the rent collectors. But in fact, if you look at how the sector has evolved over the last 20 years, there's probably no sector that's changed. I mean, the mining sector has hardly changed at all. BHP, Rio, you know, Western Mining. But the property trust sector has evolved and changed dramatically. Time after time, you had a big enthusiasm for specialized trusts. Then you had enthusiasm for diversified trusts. Then enthusiasm for staple securities. Then enthusiasm for investing offshore. Now, of course, the wheel is coming back the other way. I think that... I think you will see the rise of rent collectors. I think there is definitely a demand for what GPT used to do before they got ambitious, and that was just a good quality portfolio of low geared, well managed properties. But I think there's still mileage in staple securities, because I think there is genuine synergy between development and the funds management side. I think the main beneficiary is actually the developer rather than the property trust in that marriage. But I think staple securities will persist. I think they'll have to be more transparent. And we know that distribution policies are going to be very different going forward. I think you'll see capital coming back. It'll be a long time before we're the second largest investor in the U.S. as we have been in recent years. Capital will come back, and I think you'll also see capital from offshore coming into Australia, because we're one of the few countries that look semi-respectable at the moment. No recession, you know, yields still quite good. You know, vacancy rates very low. So. But the third change I would nominate is simply the fact that a lot of these smaller REITs, not always small ones, which have simply been financially engineered around exchange rates and hedging and not always hedging and debt and so on, are simply going to disappear. And you'll have fewer, but not necessarily less diverse, listed property securities.
Hey, any more questions?
From global REITs towards Australian REITs.
Can you repeat the question?
I think the question was, how do we see the relationship between Australian and overseas REITs, and should we be thinking about a rebalance? I think that I think if you're a, I think it depends what you're looking for. I mean, I think if you're looking, if you're looking for upside, if you're a trader, I think I would look fairly seriously at some of the UK and the US property companies, listed property companies, because they've been smashed down very seriously. I think there's opportunities there. I think if you're looking for taking a longer term view and you're looking for some upside, but basically you're looking for what you should be in property, which is yield, then I think I'd confine my attention to Australia. Partly, I suppose, because most of us just know the Australian market so much better. I think one of the things we've learned from going into offshore markets is that it might seem similar, but it can be quite different. So I think that opportunistically you might be looking offshore. There was a survey done probably 2 months ago that I can't give you the exact reference, but looking at international investors saying where the opportunities in real estate, and US REITs came out as top of the list. But I think that's a trading perspective. I think they're discounting something like 150, 175 basis points. Now,
that's including Westfield.
That's excluding Westfield. The IPD index came out yesterday, day before yesterday, and what the IPD index shows across Australia is that yields rose by 20 basis points between March and June. And I wouldn't be surprised to see another 20-25 basis points. If we get another 20-25 basis points, it'll be say 50 basis points in all. And I think that gets us back pretty much to sort of long-term benchmarks. And remember, this is prime grade property primarily in that IPD index. So prime grade yields rise by 50 basis points, but the market's discounting significantly more than that on average. I think that's where the opportunity is if you want to arbitrage between listed and unlisted. I think it's worth bearing in mind if you take the long term view, the long term return between listed and unlisted is pretty much the same. And I think whether you go listed or unlisted, I think is very much a matter of where you can arbitrage from time to time. But also just how important is liquidity for you, what's your time horizon. In terms of gross returns, there's not much, historically, there hasn't been much to choose between them.
There seems to be a lack of buyers generally in physical property markets at the moment. In the retail market, you've got a distressed seller there in Centro.
Yeah. It's not just a lack of buyers, a lack of sellers as well. I mean, there's a lack of transactions, and one of the things we want to know is just where is the market. That's why we're sort of hypothesizing about how many basis points are yields going to rise, because we don't really know. I think what you'll see, you'll start to see sales over the next 6 months or so, because people have to sell, and typically what you do is you sell your second grade stuff. I mean, GPT is clearly in the market to sell a lot of stuff, and you try to keep the family jewels, and you sell the other stuff. So that it'll be a long time before we get a good read on the prime assets. But I think you'll see second grade volumes start to rise, and there I'm quite happy to agree that yields are going to, or cap rates are going to blow out, and that's where I think you get your 150, 175 basis point decompression coming through in that sector. I can easily believe that would happen.
If that happens, then doesn't Westfield then be in a position where they're forced to write down their values?
Well, no, because they're running prime assets. That's your super regional type stuff. And I mean, my position on that would be sort of 25 basis points, maybe 50 if you want to push me a bit further. But I think that, I mean, that's my case.
Yeah, so if you're going to say Centro's selling banks down,
Yeah, well, of course, I mean, Centro's got a mixture of some very good assets and some less good assets. So it depends what actually hits the market. A lot of institutions pretty heavily cashed up at the moment, and real estate is a core part of their portfolios. Plus we are seeing increasing signs of foreigners coming in, offshore investors coming in to pick up our assets. So there won't be too many bargains, I don't think, in the market. Yeah, I'm not an engineer. I'm told on good authority by the people who design Mervac sort of buildings that steel is a pretty small item in most of their structures. So I can't give you the exact breakdown. To the extent that material costs have gone up, to that extent it certainly is a hurdle. It certainly is a constraint on development. So it does protect existing owners. But I think the real increase in cost is the cost of capital, and that probably outweighs any other. I mean, wages have been rising as well, so I think that rising costs are certainly a limiting factor. But I think the other thing you're going to see in construction, I think you're going to see a big drop in construction over the next 12 months, 2 years. Interestingly, if you go to the Reserve Bank website and look at that, they have this chart book. And they show this chart. They have this chart showing work to be done, construction work to be done, and it's been rising for quite some time, and it rose steadily and steadily up until end of last year. And I always said, well, that rise says that there's a lot more construction coming through because there's work to be done. There's obviously a big pipeline, and in the last 6 months, it's risen absolutely vertically. Now, I think that's work to be done, which may never happen. It's work to be done sitting in the inventory, and I think what you're getting now is a build-up of postponed projects. So work to be done looks as if it's exploding, but actually it'll be 3 or 4 years before it actually happens. So I think there's going to be a big fall in non-residential construction, which will take some of the cost pressure off materials, off labour, and off urban, you know, off land as well.
John, then George, then I'll hand it over to Stephen.
Just going to residential real estate, what's your medium-term outlook considering the increasing pressures on rental costs and of course, migration?
We're producing over the last 12 months, we produced 147,000 dwellings in Australia. Underlying demand is 187,000. If you look at the ANZ calculations, we're heading towards a shortfall of 200,000 dwellings. That's the lack, you know, which is more than one year's supply. Interest rates may fall on Tuesday afternoon. If they don't fall on Tuesday afternoon, they will fall over the next few months. Historically, in every cyclical turnaround since 1965, falling interest rates has been what ignited a recovery in the housing market. Here we've got a huge undersupply, strong demand, falling interest rates. It's very hard for me not to see the market recovering, although the timing is obviously very hard to predict. But even if housing construction does recover, it'll be a long time before we absorb the backlog. So I think rental vacancy rates remain low. I think rents rise. The last 10 years, if you look at the ratio of rents to wages, rents on Real Estate Institute numbers, rents have accounted for 22% of household income. 22% of household income until about 18 months ago. And since then, it's risen from 22% to 25%. So the chart suddenly goes up. But I don't think 25% is that tough, you know? I mean, I lived for many years paying more than 25% of my income on rent. I think there's still scope for rents to rise.
Given what you know? Mervac pay you.
Well, that's why I went to work for Mervac, because I wanted to get into the property ownership area. But no, I mean I'm saying, you know, it looks like a sharp rise, but 25%. the average homeowner, average home purchaser, is paying about 35 to 40% of their household income. So the tilt is still very much, if you want to minimize your accommodation cost, rent. And that is that remains the case. I keep telling my son that, but he still lives at home.
Just would like your comment on the magnitude of the disaster that's unfolded in the property index. From 2,600 to 12, it's a 60% decline. And there it was, you've mentioned GPT. I said, geez, 220 GPT, NTA's 380. I know that's going to get hit. So I've started reweighting towards them and Goodman. But between the two of them, they've had $12 billion of market cap wiped out. So I started buying at 220 GPT. Goodman's at around $283. And now the clients that I put in, they're down 10, 15%. And I think what's going on here is the fear that I've been given back to me from people is that, well, they've sourced finance from commercial mortgage-backed securities. GPT's not going to get that debt refinance. It's going to be a forced seller of up to $6 billion of assets. And really, you're an idiot having bought it at $2.20. I said, I'm an idiot. Who were the idiots paying $5 6 months ago? So is your view that this sell-off is now overdone? There is some logic in coming back into the market at these prices? And is the paranoia out there around the REITs, the listed REITs, overdone?
Gee, I wish you hadn't asked me that question. Well, I think the short answer is yes. I mean, it was overdone on the way up, and it's been overdone on the way down. But as I've tried to argue, I think a lot of the discounting that you're seeing is reflects exposure to offshore markets rather than domestic markets.
10-15% of their assets.
I think there's also it's exposure to offshore assets. It's high levels of debt. And the worry about refinancing that debt, and credit spreads haven't narrowed. Credit spreads are as wide as they were pretty much at the height of the crisis, you know, 3 or 4 months ago. I think there is a deep discount which reflects fear, anxiety, you know. But it also reflects the fact that a lot of REITs are reviewing their payout policies, their distribution policies. Distributions are going to be lower going forward, and I think the market is pricing that in. What they may not be doing is pricing in the benefits of a lower distribution policy in terms of higher growth, because REITs have been hugely generous in giving money back to unit holders. They've also been hugely greedy in taking money back from unit holders. If you compare the REIT sector with the mining sector has generated far more cash net than the REIT sector has. The REIT sector has produced huge amounts of cash and absorbed huge amounts of cash back again. Now, what you're going to see is less cash going out, but less cash having to be drawn back in. I think the market is at the moment is focused on the negatives, and let's face it, there are negatives out there. I think it may not be fully pricing in.
For Westfield, it's held put up on a pedestal, and the REIT sector, like GPT's got 48%, 43-48%, best to worst.
I think you're going to see those gearing rates come down, and you've got very few options. Either you raise capital, or you sell assets, or you cut distributions. I mean, you know, those are your choices. Now, I think you're going to see some of that all the way through. When I say that you look for expect returns of 10%, the old ratio 3% growth, 7% yield, I think that's where you're going to get to. But between getting from here to there, there's going to be pain. There'll be opportunities. There's going to be pain, and some of the REITs are just going to disappear, and they may not be able to refinance themselves. They'll have to sell assets. So you know, I wouldn't deny that at all.
Folks, it's a rare pleasure and a rare privilege to have a presentation like this. Okay, start to think about what voting you're going to make, and in the interim, I'll ask Stephen just to pop up and make a few comments about Mirvac, and then ask you to vote.
Thanks, David. I'm not going to take very long. I'm just going to give you a couple of quick thoughts. I'm going to try and steer away from the product, which those of you that know me, something I don't like to do at a public meeting. The debt markets are really interesting at the moment. have a look at the capital stack of real estate, the largest part of the capital stack is debt. It's been a dreadful thing to have been in the last 12 months. But right now, I've never seen lending opportunities like it. If you're a cashed-up fund and looking to lend today, you can easily achieve 400 or 500 basis points over the swap rate on 50-55% hard-marked LVRs. The banks aren't lending. The credit markets are pretty much dried up. And I think that you will start to see institutions come into this space, superannuation funds and others that are benefiting from system growth, and there will be some products coming up in that space where you'll be able to get some very interesting returns. In the REITs market, I think the opportunities are ahead of the REITs market given its current price. In the unlisted syndicate market, I think the risks are ahead of it because I don't think they fully recognise the price. But there are a couple of areas that you might want to have a look at. And I'm going to talk about a particular product now. You're all professionals here, and I'm not promoting this other than as an idea. Mirvac manages a thing called the Mirvac PFA Fund. Recently announced its results. I think the income distribution is now about 7.2 or 3 cents a unit. Marked its unit price back. I think it came down to about 28, is that right? Very transparent. Got a good set of properties. It's got some good income streams ahead of it. Its debt's under control. You can buy that on the BSX today at 66 cents. It's ridiculous. I mean, the BSX is a crap market. You'd never want to put a product onto the BSX, the NSX. And I question whether it even should probably be on listed markets. There's a whole new debate. Dave and I have had it many times.
Sorry, what's the BSX,
man?
Bendigo Stock Exchange.
Not a great place for liquidity, but you know, there are opportunities out there. Just what you've got to do is step aside from where your thinking was and apply new thinking to where we are today. And we are in a very different marketplace. Don't fall in love with old girlfriends or boyfriends. Think about where we are today. Transparency, clarity is the key. You want to understand what they're doing, how much they're charging for what they're doing, what are the risks in there, and the risks relate to the fees that they charge you, the level of debt, the cost of that debt, the quality of the income streams going forward, the ability for those income streams to be grown. And there are some very good opportunities out there. There's no doubt about that. And we've got an industrial trust in America, which is at the other end of things. I think that's trading at about 22 cents on net asset backing north of 80, with a dividend yield on the marketplace at the moment close to 40%. Now, what does that tell you? It's telling you that it's either pricing in that the asset value is going to fall by half, or that the Aussie dollar is going to go 2-1 to the US. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff you can do it. It's just a nonsense. What I'm saying to you is just step aside from old ways of thinking and really apply some common sense. You're back to basics. That's really what you're doing. You're back to basics. And it's a very interesting time. People tell me how bad are things, right? Or people ask me how bad are things going forward. And I'm fortunate in the one hand and unfortunate because of age, who have actually gone through three of these types of events in my business career. The fortunate is that I've learned from them. The unfortunate is it means that I'm in my 50s. And I'd much rather be having this experience 20 years younger and being able to apply it then. The interesting thing that I observe is that what goes round comes round. You know, the transparency didn't exist in mining companies like Poseidon and things like that. Educational companies like ABC fall in love with clarity, fall in love with transparency, and how the hell can you recommend anything if you can't understand it? Now, that's really the key to success going forward. And the good news is, sorry, the bad news is, if you're planning on dying in the next 12 months, hands up those of you that are planning on dying. The good news is then you're not going to have such a shitty time. But the next 12 months is going to be pretty ordinary, I think, for a lot of people. So those that are planning on dying, don't. Those that are planning on living, harness your cash well, invest it wisely, be very sensible with it. Don't believe anybody, particularly people like me that are salespeople. And you know, you're all smart enough to make your own judgment. Thanks, and thanks for coming today.
Okay, folks, time to turn on technology. I will bring up the